From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Andrew Liptak, whose recent book is Cosplay, a History, The Builders, Fans, and Makers Who Bring Your Favorite Stories to Life, published by Saga Press. Andrew Liptak is a writer and historian from Vermont. He has worked as a journalist for more than a decade, appearing in places such as Clark's World magazine, Gizmodo, Grist, Kirkus Reviews, Life Hacker, and others. He writes a regular newsletter about the intersection of speculative fiction and real life, Transfer Orbit. His first short story, Fragmented, appeared in Galaxy's Edge magazine in 2014, and that same year he co-edited the anthology War Stories, New Military Science Fiction. Andrew Liptak graduated in 2007 from Norwich University with a bachelor's in history and minor in geology, and in 2009 with a master's degree in military history. He attended the Launch Pad Astronomy Workshop in 2014 and is an official mad scientist for the U.S. Army's Training and Doctrine Command. A history of the colorful and complex kingdom of cosplay and fandom fashion by Andrew is his new book, Cosplay. In recent years, cosplay, the practice of dressing up in costume as a character, has exploded, becoming a mainstream cultural phenomenon. But what are the circumstances that made its rise possible? Andrew is a member of the legendary 501st Legion, an international fan-based organization dedicated to the dark side of Star Wars. And he delves into the origins and culture of cosplay to answer this question in his book, Cosplay, a History. The book looks at the practices, ever-growing fandom and conventions, its roots in 15th century costuming, the relationship between franchises and cosplayers that are inspired by this, and the technology that brings even the most intricate details in these costumes to life. So we discussed all that in our interview, too. When I spoke with Andrew, I asked him to begin by talking about cosplay, what it is, and how he got involved. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Cosplay history is, I've been doing that since almost 20 years. I got started when I was in just out of high school. And my personal origin story was that I was a big Star Wars fan as a teenager. And for 6 years while in high school, middle school and high school, I pestered my music director to let us play Star Wars in band. And after 6 years, he relented. And so to make the evening a little bit more memorable, we reached out to a group called the 501st Legion, which I had heard about through sort of Star Wars fan circles and magazines. And we were able to get a trooper to come up from Rhode Island. So we drove all the way from Rhode Island to Vermont, and blew everybody away, blew me away, and at the end of the evening, I was like, so how do I get one of these for myself? And he ended up selling me a kit to make my own later that summer, and so that's where I got my first costume. And from there, I basically, I was in college. I didn't really wear it that much. I worked at a bookstore, so like Halloween, and work, and the occasional summer camp thing where I worked over the course of summer. And it wasn't until after I got out of college that I really sort of got back into it. Along the way, I had gone to a convention in Indianapolis, Star Wars Celebration 3, and met more troopers. That sort of really cemented home, like, that, there's lots more people who do this, and they encouraged me to sort of get in touch when I was had more time and ability to sort of drive around on my own and have an independent whatnot. So after I graduated and got a job, I was able to do that. And basically sort of fell into doing what we call trooping. So what the 501st does is we do parades, we do conventions, and a lot of charity work. So that's sort of the tempo that I fell into. So we'd go to the Warbone Parade, we did local conventions, and I started looking for events to do up here in Vermont. Because I was only one of a couple troopers. And so, like, as time went on, I was an Imperial Stormtrooper. When you go to conventions and other things like that, you start to, like, all right, what other costumes could I do? So I eventually made a a closure book of Attack of the Clones, and then got some jumpsuits for some other franchises, and sort of kept with it. So that's sort of my cosplay origin story.
I feel silly that I was calling it cosplay. It never even occurred to me that the cause is for costume, and that's so obvious.
it's totally obvious because that word came about in the 1980s when a Japanese fan went to a WorldCon in LA, and he was writing some fanzines back at home and was trying to figure out, like, all right, how do I adequately describe this, what I'm seeing to my readers? Apparently, the term, what science fiction fans called it at the time, was masquerading, and there wasn't really, like, I guess the term for masquerade didn't quite translate and convey what he wanted to convey. Mm-hmm. So he basically said, all right, well, let's match up costume and play, and that's where the term comes from.
Yeah.
And ever since, it's sort of been associated within, like, the Japanese anime circles, so because of that, sort of that origin. For a long time, a lot of, like, Final First folks, there's sort of these different traditions within the science fiction fandom world and the cosplay world. So the Stormtrooper stuff came out of a whole different, sort of a different tradition. In cosplay has been sort of, like, for a long time seen as, like, the Japanese anime costume side of things. And nowadays, it's sort of a much broader umbrella term. It's a little bit more widely accepted.
What you said that you started, you started in high school, but then when you're in college, you occasionally would wear your Stormtrooper costume. So what year would that have been?
The concert was in 2003, and so I placed my order and got the armor at the end of that summer. I don't remember the exact date, but it was probably like August. And so I had it ready to go for that Halloween, and so that's why I wore it. And then I worked at a summer camp for a couple more years after that, so I would bring it to the summer camp as a counselor and a director. And so I would, for skits or for, just various games that we play with the campers, we work it into, something. So that's where it got a lot of use. Because, kids love Star Wars and Stormtroopers and stuff, so it was always fun to sort of suit up and get chased around or chase around them.
Yeah. And the book gives a lot of history about this, which I found really interesting. But that's a good time placement. 2003, it's kind of new. It hasn't really exploded the way that it has since then.
I've always found my own personal space or my own personal history of this to be really interesting. It straddles these two eras, right? So, like, 2003, the prequel trilogy hadn't quite finished coming out yet. So it was sort of like those early sort of Star Wars times. This cosplay was definitely not a mainstream thing. People thought it was neat, but they're also like, oh, that's kind of weird. And then over the course of that, almost 20 years, we've seen such an incredible shift. There's lots of reasons for that, but, like, San Diego Comic-Con's popularity has exploded. You have TV shows like The Big Bang Theory, which really, were massive hits, and they really sort of showed people that, this is a thing that these characters do, and they sort of, introducing the concept to a lot of people. Social Networks, I think, did very much the same thing, as they sort of introduced these concepts to folks, and they're like, this is an activity you can take part in, and you can build these costumes yourself. And so, like, that, it's been interesting just to sort of see the progression in just that 20 years.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, too, how on Halloween we all let ourselves kind of cut loose and dress up. And yet, you write in the book about having been at an event at Toys R Us and a woman sort of disparagingly calling what was going on creepy. I do think there's still a large segment of the population that would find this, if not creepy, then, outside of their comfort zone. And it's interesting that we sort of assign a certain day to allow ourselves this, and that the rest of the time, most of us probably wouldn't put costumes on, but it is clearly something we enjoy, right?
Yeah, so. It's a form of play. And I think that there is a stigma against adults enjoying themselves. but at the same time, we don't bat an eye when somebody, dresses up in a hockey jersey or a football jersey or a baseball jersey and celebrate, you know, they might paint themselves or go all out with their office and decorate dressed up with their favorite sports team or spend lots of money on, you know, these sorts of hobbies. And I think that there's just this general unease with people, like, just having fun and playing. And that's basically what this is. It's a form of entertainment. It's a form of play that it's incredibly important for people to do and to take part in, just for our mental health and just for just generally having a social life. But, you know, there are certainly people, like, if I do an event out on the street, you know, there'll definitely people who, like, will not look at us. You know, we're not looking in that direction. We don't acknowledge you. That's come a long way, I think. I think that more people are just sort of familiar with content. You know, a lot of this comes down to, like, just familiarity and context. Like, you know, you see somebody dressed up as a soldier, but you don't know necessarily what they're doing. But nowadays, I think that the science fiction fantasy stories and storytelling has sort of permeated into popular culture in such a way that we are a little bit more aware of what it is. Yeah. And like, oh, it's cosplay is a far more mainstream thing than it was 20 years ago.
Yeah. It's funny, though, what you're saying reminds me a little bit of the Dursleys in Harry Potter and how, you know, anything outside of the norm made them uncomfortable, right? And and we all read that book and laughed and thought, oh, those people are so uptight. But in fact, those people were just kind of people.
I think it's a really good idea. Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate.
Let's talk about the book itself. How did you come to write this book? And what was the most fun research that you did while you were writing the book?
So I came to write the book. I was a journalist, and I worked for a bunch of websites to cover pop culture, technology, science, sort of geek sphere world. So I covered a lot of those things, and particularly I like to cover science fiction fantasy topics. So I had written a lot about science fiction fantasy, and I reviewed a lot of books, and I reviewed a bunch of books from a press called Saga Press, from Simon Schuster, and I knew the editor a little bit. And I was in 2015, he went to San Diego Comic-Con and met a guy dressed as a stormtrooper who had marched 501 miles from upstate California to San Diego. His wife had died of complications from cancer, and he was raising awareness for that. And he had heard the story, and was like, wow, this is a really, you know, incredible thing that he did. Like, he reached out to me because he knew that I was also involved in this world. And was like, is there a story here that we can explore? And the original idea was to sort of look at the history of the 501st Legion. And we went back and forth quite a bit. We made a pitch, and then as I was sort of developing the story, realized that we need to put more context in. So that I had a chapter, I think the original draft, I had a chapter about the history of cosplay that would have been sort of a thumbnail of you know, how it sort of generally progressed. And the more I worked on it, and the more we sort of thought about it, I was like, all right, I guess we really need to, you know, the final part is a much smaller part of the story. The larger history is a much more interesting thing. So that's sort of where the origins of the book came from. So we sold the book in, February or March 2019. And I spent the next year, all the way up to about a week before the pandemic started here in Vermont, writing and doing research. So I turned my draft in right before the lockdowns happened. And so part of that was research. We made the announcement while I was at Star Wars Celebration in Chicago, and I had started taking photographs of people. Over the course of that summer, I went to a whole bunch of other conventions. So Boston Fan Expo, Dragon Con, Rhode Island Comic Con, all with the intent of taking pictures. Meeting people and sitting down and chatting with them. These conventions are where people gather, so it was a good opportunity to schedule stuff and see what was out there, and basically expand my catalog of images. Along the way, I attended the premiere of Rise of Skywalker in 2019, on that trip, I flew into San Francisco and interviewed Adam Savage of Mythbusters fame, and that was really enlightening. And then, you know, over the course that followed, you know, lots of phone calls and Zoom meetings, just sort of chatting with people about, you know, how they got into the hobby and like what their perspective was. And after, you know, I turned the draft in and they, you know, COVID came and it took a little while for that to work its way through the editorial process. So I was also doing more editing and writing while after that draft had been turned in. I ended up writing an additional chapter about COVID and some other things. You know, every time I would do a new interview, I would learn something new and we have to integrate it in somehow. Mm-hmm. It's like turning over a rock, you find a whole bunch of other things. So at some point, you just have to say, you know, can't do anymore. So it's not quite, there's no way to do a comprehensive history, but I think I covered a nice broad swath of it.
Yeah. Now, I wondered if you ever went back and forth at all about whether or not to include yourself as a character in the book. I say a character, but was this always going to be a memoir, at least in part? I know it's not a memoir, but you're definitely a part of the story that you tell, and for good reason.
I mean, I certainly don't see it as a memoir or anything like that. It's more of a, just sort of acknowledging that, I've been part of this world, and it would be kind of hard to sort of do a journalistic detached thing of somebody coming in cold. I sort of wanted to acknowledge that, these are the change, my experience here is like, these are the changes I've seen over the past 20 years. Sort of like, looking at it from my perspective, it's certainly a book that's a little bit more slanted towards the Star Wars tradition end of things, just because that's where my background lies. I was never a huge anime fan, and I was never, certainly wasn't around for like the cons in the 1960s, 1970s. That was basically where I could root my expertise. It was in the history of the 501st area, and then using that as sort of an anchor point to go back and sort of look at like how does my experience sort of fit in this much larger tradition. Does that make sense?
It does, absolutely. Now you've had some kind of high level appearances. You've appeared with Weird Al Yankovic, which I think is high level, and Snoop Dogg.
Yes.
How did those things come about?
So one of the fun things about the 501st is we as a group have a very close working relationship with Lucasfilm, which is first an independent studio and now it's owned by Disney. I want to say shortly after the 501st started up in 97, 98, Lucasfilm became aware of it, and they had a dedicated person named Steve Sansweet, who is a fan relations, and he reached out to them, met them, and basically was like, this is a really cool thing. Just don't monetize what you're doing, don't infringe on our IP, that sort of thing. And basically in exchange, what happens is, if they need stormtroopers or costume characters for stuff, they can reach out to us. The 501st has a certain level of quality that they require to come in. So like if you want to come in with a stormtrooper, we have a list of criteria that you have to meet in order for your costume to be accepted. And the result of that is that you can go anywhere in the world and you can find troopers that will look largely the same, look the same build quality and the same appearance, rather than people using all different types of materials or whatnot. And that's not like the end all be all of cosplay. It's certainly a gorgeous one way to do it. But if they need stormtroopers, they can reach out to us and buy them. So I want to say over the years we'd get notifications that we've got a casting gig coming up, and so we wouldn't usually know what they were until we got started on that day. So and Weird Al would know. His people would reach out to us and they'd be like, we need a number of stormtroopers to stand on either side, and we'd go to the concert, do our early do a routine with his people, and then go up on stage and do our thing and then come back off. The Snoop Dogg one, I think, was just sort of a regular paid casting gig, where it basically went to reach out to models, and so that's basically how we'd be treated. So it was sort of those are sort of paid opportunities. We basically got a call, we went down to New York City, and they put us up at a hotel, and basically said, all right, show up at this early call hour, and suit up, and we'll go out and do our thing, and so that's what we do. Also, it was on the Today Show, and did something similar. They did a Star Wars Day, and we had a call time of like 4 a.m., and I was they got us on screen, we did the opening shot, we're like, all right, you're done. And it was like 5 seconds of screen time, which is we always get a laugh at. More recently, I was on the Macy's Day Parade in 2021, with Disney had the line Stormtroopers for that, so I was one of the ones who marched to the Macy's Day Parade in Ottawa, which was quite a lot of fun. So it was sort of a recent high-profile gig. Yeah. That was a memorable thing.
Is the Stormtrooper your only costume? Like you don't like dip into stories?
No, I've got an Imperial Stormtrooper from A New Hope. I've got a Attack of the Clones era Clone Trooper, a First Order Stormtrooper from The Force Awakens, a Short Trooper from Rogue One. I have a 212th Airborne Clone from Revenge of the Sith that is not quite ready for me to wear. I need to get it to fit me. And I've got a Rebel Pilot from Rogue One as well. And in addition to that, I've got a jumpsuit from the film Moon. Duncan Jones, it was like 2009 film, which is basically just a jumpsuit with pockets, patches on it. A belter from The Expanse, which is basically the same thing, a Stargate SG-1 off-duty uniform. So the jumpsuits are really easy to do because all you have to do is sew on patches, and you can walk around a convention and be relatively comfortable. Stormtroopers and armored characters are a little bit more involved. I can get my Stormtrooper on in about 15 minutes because I've practiced it so many times. My first Order trip was about 50 pounds of fiberglass, and it takes a little bit more to get on. I need an outfit for that. So.
Now, you write about how hard it used to be to get costumes, but it sounds like the challenge of making them is part of the fun. Is it a drag or do you find that something's been lost in the fact that now it's so easy to get costumes, like for $50 on Amazon, no, as you say?
Absolutely not. There's a joy in building this stuff, and it takes a certain skill level to do it, but it's a skill level that's learnable, and any skill you put into making a suit of armor or any costume, those you can apply elsewhere. So it's definitely worth doing. Buying costumes off the rack is way less valid than making one yourself. And the nice thing about like this, this drop in price and access means that more people can do it. There's a reason why the 501st is it's largely male dominated, largely a lot of white guys, in their probably 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. Just demographically, that's the population of people who can basically afford to drop a $500 or $1,000 or $2,000 on one of these types of costumes. That's not great demographically. You want a diverse pool of people because, the more diverse your community is, the stronger it is. Being able to use cheaper materials, EVA foam armor is a really great advance because, it's cheap. People can learn to do it really easily. They can make really incredible things with it. That's a big plus there. And, you don't have to do the 100% screen accurate thing to be valid as a cosplayer. The 501st has its own entry requirements, but that's not the end-all and be-all of Star Wars cosplay. So, anything you can do to reduce the barrier to entry into a hobby is great because that means more people can enjoy it, they can express themselves, they can be part of that fandom and be part of that community. And the more people we have, the better it is.
Are there equivalents to the 501st for The Hobbit and Game of Thrones and things like that? I mean,
there are other organized groups out there. So Star Trek fandom has a lot of folks. It has a very a long-standing thing that they are a long-standing group and organization. There is the 405th, which does Halo cosplay, and they make their own armor, and that's a little bit more challenging because everything is sort of custom-made. Mm-hmm. With Stormtroopers and Star Wars characters, you have a lot of characters that look like Stormtroopers are easy because you can mass produce them. There's sort of fan groups. I don't know if there's any organized fan groups like the 501st. It's sort of its weird, its own thing in the fan world. Because it is just because of the way it's been organized. There's certainly bands that will gravitate towards franchises over time. And right now, Lord of the Rings is having its own moment because of the Ring of Power TV show. So that's, you know, that's having its own sort of time to shine right now. And there's you know, there's other franchises out there that have these you know, are sort of popular in the moment. Like Stranger Things is big. The Witcher is a big thing. Game of Thrones is back because it has the new House of the Dragon series. And you know, as you have new shows coming out, you know, in the course of the entertainment year, you'll have, you know, the sort of the popularity rise and fall. But yeah, like the Followers is weird because it is a very organized group. It's sort of democratically organized. We elect our leaders. We're organized geographically into local garrisons. And, you know, I think with that infrastructure, you have the ability to sort of scale up. We have about 15,000 people worldwide, I think. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
Okay. 15,000, that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
Now, you have a chapter in the book titled Protest Cosplay, in which you write, even outside of protest in the political sphere, activists don costumes in service of their causes. And right before that, you write, there are also bad actors who look to reappropriate historical imagery for their own purposes. So I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about this aspect of the book and of cosplay.
Yeah, that part came out of a report that I wrote when I was working for a site called The Verge. And what I had been struck by, the series of Handmaid's Tale had come out 2017. There were a bunch of anti-abortion bills going through the Texas legislature, and there was these very dramatic images of women dressed as handmaids from The Handmaid's Tale in the state legislature. And very quickly, this spread around to other chapters of this movement around the country. It was, I think, the Handmaids Alliance, and they were basically, you know, they wanted to protest all these bills that were popping up all over the country. And so I interviewed a couple of folks there, and they had basically gathered in small chapters around the country, and had, I think, their eventual goal was basically to stage a protest in every state capital around the country. That movement has sort of fallen apart since then. I haven't really seen too much from them. I tried to check in with a couple of them when I was writing the book. I never quite heard back, so I think there's some folks have moved on to other things. Their point was to basically use the emotional resonance with The Handmaid's Tale and try to, you know, bring that into the real world. And certainly having the TV show as a visual guide didn't hurt. So that was a huge, bit of work behind why I wanted to include that. And when I came to write the book, I wanted to see, like, what other examples have we had. So, like, you go back to the suffragette movement, and you have women dressed as Columbia or Liberty for these protests, and these very dramatic pictures and very forceful. It's this very forceful imagery. And you see this in other avenues as well. You have people, the Tea Party protesters around, was it 2009, 2010, you know, they're dressing up as Revolutionary War soldiers, and it's the same logic is behind that. You know, they're trying to sort of capture the idea of this story and what it means, and trying to sort of convey that to an audience. Out in the world. So that's a big thing. But I'm pretty sure that we won't see that go away at all. As far as people appropriating stuff, like I think what my thinking was behind that is that there are, you know, people on the internet, you know, or in certain fan circles will try to use costumes to just sort of promote their ideology or to troll people. There was a couple of incidents within the furry community where people were dressing up as, like, alt-right or, outright Nazi-like furry characters, right down to an armband, and just sort of, promoting this fascist ideology, and, or at least just the, as I said, or at least just trying to get a rise out of people. I think that there's probably a mix of people just being obnoxious and people being earnestly And so, like, you know, those are things that people can, you know, that, because, you know, if you lean into this imagery, you are sort of coming to sort of, you know, in the right circumstances, you're sort of trying to, you know, push this forward and to sort of get some visibility on it. And certainly, like, with the 501st and the Star Wars world, just to go back to that for a second, like, you know, these are costumes that have a deep background in, like, an inspiration from World War II. So, you know, there's certainly design congruities from, like, you know, what the Nazis wore in World War II to, you know, what George Lucas was putting on set, because he wanted to sort of convey, like, you know, these guys are evil. And I think that the nice thing, like, the Stormtroopers, like, you know, they're a little bit cartoonish. You know, you are, and we try to basically promote, like, the bad guys doing good. And the way I look at it is that, you know, we're not really, you know, I certainly don't identify with any sort of fascist ideology, but it's like, you know, I'm trying to represent the Star Wars franchise. And I think when people see a Stormtrooper, they see Star Wars, not really the ideology behind it. Although that said, like, you know, the reason the show Andor, like, they really lean into some of the evilness, and, like, you know, I'm not really sure I would want to wear a security officer trench coat or something, because it's just, it really drives that point home. And, so, like, you know, there's a give and take and a balance to a lot of it, to sort of figure out what's the right audience, and, like, you know, what's appropriate for, you know, at a convention versus, like, you know, being out in the street with it or something. So
right, when you do write about street performances and the history behind costumes and how they've always helped performers convey a story. And this reminded me of, there's something in Spain called La Tuna. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but it's a centuries old tradition of students dressing up in, I guess it's sort of medieval costume, and singing in the streets. And you see them everywhere, and you see them on the trains, and you see them on. So anyway, that just brought me right back to there.
Cause, oh, I haven't heard that one.
Yeah, I had been a student in Spain.
So, there are lots of, like, costume traditions, and, like, there was no way, I basically tried to cover, like, the broad swath of them.
Yeah, no, there's so many.
With the book, but, like, people like to dress up and to be in these costumes to perform and to sort of bring these traditions alive. And just, you could write an entire book about, like, the costume traditions from, you know, Europe and Asia and South America, and just try to understand why people do it. And I think that I look at these things as sort of not necessarily cosplay, but I wanted to include some of them just because it gets to this innate idea of why do we dress up, and, like, how did costumes become a thing? Certainly there's, you know, religious ceremonies and theatrical performances throughout the centuries. How has that evolved, and how has that sort of percolated into the modern day, and has it changed into the modern day? So, you know, we draw a lot of cues from folk tradition and from religious ceremony and agricultural ceremony and things like that. So, like, and it's been interesting. It's fascinating to watch the transition over time. To, you know, there's folks who will dress up as, you know, like right now, Krampus is a thing. It's in festivals all over the world, and just sort of seeing how that sort of sits alongside the cosplay world. And I actually know some cosplayers who have dressed up as Krampus, and those skills transfer from one to the other, which is pretty neat.
Yeah, that's great. What are you writing anything else now?
I don't have anything that I've pitched to my publisher. I read a newsletter about science fiction, fantasy writing, reading, called Transfer Orbit, and that's one of the things I've been wanting to do, and I haven't quite gotten around to doing it over the course of the summer, was to do what I would call lost chapters, which is stuff that I wanted to include in the book, but didn't get a chance to. And, you know, I would be learning about stuff, and then, you know, I turned in my manuscript, and it was like, I was writing it right up to the last minute, changing and editing things before my editor was like, "Okay, it's got to be in." So there are things that didn't make it quite in that I wanted to include. Like, one was Arthur Conan Doyle dressed up as one of his characters, Professor Challenger, which I learned, like, the day after I turned my draft in, and I was like, "Ah, crap." So, like, that's one thing I've been meaning to write up. There was a story here in Vermont about some protesters in Burlington who had been, the police had basically gotten them to remove their masks, citing like a really old law about the KKK, an anti-masking law. That's the government we want to dig into. And then, you know, things like Krampus. My wife was telling me the other day, like, yeah, I really need to write up something about that because it's going to be, you know, clowns, furries, things like that, like just stuff that didn't quite make the cut to get in. But so that's something I'm hoping to get to at some point.
Mm-hmm. How do people find your newsletter?
It's called Transfer Orbit. It's got kind of a convoluted URL, transfer-orbit.ghost.io. But if you sort of type in my name and newsletter, you'll probably find it. Or if you look at the links on any of my social media profiles, you can it's linked there. And I'm usually pretty good about whenever I post up something new, I will share that out. So that's one good way to find it.
Okay, great. I always ask my guests what they have read lately that they might recommend to listeners. What do you like to read, and have you read anything lately that you would recommend?
We just Continent, The Epic Quest for North America by, I'm not going to pronounce the author's name right, Pekka Hamalainen. That's one I run the bookstore at the Vermont Historical Society, so it's one that I'm considering stocking. It's basically a history of Native Americans in North America, basically like how did, without the sort of, not from a European lens, which I'm finding really fascinating. Fiction-wise, I just picked up H.P. Lovecraft's at the Mountains of Madness, which is a classic weird horror story from the 1930s. I've got a book called The Icarus Plot by Timothy Zahn, which is a space opera. Shadow of the Sith by Adam Christopher, which is a Star Wars novel. And I've got sort of a long to-read list of other books as well that I've just been trying to get through.
Did you pick up the Lovecraft because of all of the new H.P. Lovecraft stuff that's available on television right now, or are you always reading that stuff?
It's what I've had for a while. I just wrote a piece for the newsletter about Guillermo del Toro just released an adaptation of Pinocchio, and he's been talking about how he The Mountains of Madness is one of the books he's been wanting to adapt for a long time. He had a major one on the table for maybe 10 years ago that didn't ultimately didn't go anywhere, and I was basically making the argument that Netflix would be in a good position to do a sort of Lovecraft franchise, because there's a lot of material to mine, but also it's sort of a plug and play. It's always been sort of this plug and play open source franchise, because Lovecraft would invite his friends to write alongside him in the same world, and you can do the same thing with directors and different stories, and you can really, through that model, you can upend a lot of sort of the racism and horribleness that Lovecraft was known for, and sort of subvert a lot of what he was doing, while telling some really cool stories. So there are lots of, Peter J. Clark wrote a great book called Ring Shout. N.K. Jemisin has The City We Became and The World We Make. And Winston Emery's had two books, and I'm blanking on the name off the top of my head, that were also sort of using the tropes that Lovecraft put together and upended them as a queer woman, and basically looked at the world through some of the monsters' eyes, or as the otherworldly creatures' eyes. You could do the same with you could do the same thing with a film franchise if you sort of have a good thing to lead with. And it's basically just a little bit of think piece, speculation on what might be kind of fun to see. And while writing that, I picked it up to sort of page through, and I haven't really actually read the whole thing through, so I think it's maybe a good time to finally actually do that.
Yeah. So I always finish up my interviews with a question about advice for writers, and you're welcome to go whichever way you want. But I started thinking, I wonder if dressing in costume is a way for writers to access something about the worlds they're trying to create, or if that's too hard to organize. But what do you think, or what advice would you offer to writers?
Oh, certainly they should pick up cosplay. It's a lot of fun, and I know writers who do that. is a great military science fiction writer over in New Hampshire named Marco Klaus, who he actually commissioned a uniform from one of the one of his books. So he's worn. He was telling me that it was prohibitively expensive because of the fabrics and the tailoring and everything. So be warned that it can be kind of an expensive thing because you would be basically creating something from scratch without, you know, visual representation, which is what most of cosplay deals with. But like, one of the things I talked about in the book was I visited Fort Ticonderoga in New York and spoke with the folks who do the living history there, and they, you know, by dressing them in costume, they get a good sense of like what it was like to live as these people, like, you know, what is it like to wear this uniform, or to, and like what types of things can you learn from it. So there's certainly value in you know, experiential learning in that way. So like, if I ever write a science fiction story about armor, I am definitely going to incorporate what I have learned by wearing armor. And just, you know, the same way that, like, you know, if you were a veteran and you want to bring a little bit more depth of perspective to that character, you're going to draw from your experience. So I think that is always a good thing to do, rather than sort of speculating. And you know, when I've written fiction, you know, I try to very much to do some research into, like, what is it like to, you know, to do any element that these characters are doing. So, like, I recently wrote a thing for a project about denuclearization, and it involved some time and space. So I've read a lot about spacesuits, and I've read a lot about, like, how, just through my work as a journalist, like, how an EVA might be conducted. So, like, obviously I can't go up into space and wear a spacesuit myself, but, you know, I can certainly watch videos and sort of understand, like, you know, what goes into one of those things because they have cameras on their helmets and spacesuits. So I would say, like, you know, if I was to, for, you know, fiction-wise, like, certainly anything you can do to sort of drop a little bit of realism in, just and sort of just understanding what the details are and what goes into it, I think it's certainly valuable. As far as writing history, certainly there is always research you can do, and certainly keeping an open mind and then following up a little bit of the story here and there as you discover things is certainly good. Although with the understanding that, you know, you turn over a rock, you're going to find more stories. At some point, you just have to sort of constrain yourself and not go off on random tangents. And this is one reason why I didn't include a chapter about, like, the use of costumes of the KKK in the book. I hoped to, because it was just too far. It was too far afield from what my thesis for the book was. Also, it's kind of just a bummer.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to mention again, the name of the book is Cosplay, A History, The Builders, Fans, and Makers Who Bring Your Favorite Stories to Life. And it's by Andrew Liptak, my guest today, and it's published by Saga Press. So, Andrew, thank you so much for speaking with me. It's very interesting.
Thank you.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Vermont author Andrew Liptak about his book Cosplay, A History, The Builders, Fans, and Makers Who Bring Your Favorite Stories to Life, published by Saga Press. This week's Write the Book prompt won't surprise you if you listen to the interview. Dress in costume and write about the person you see yourself representing. If you have a costume that works for a character that you are trying to figure out, then that's great. If you don't have a costume that works for that character, try to change one thing about your appearance to help you access that character. Does your character have a mustache and you do not? Stick on a fake or draw one above your lip. Does your character wear a tiara or pencil skirts or stilettos or sandals or penny loafers? Figure out what you can try on that's maybe a little different from what you normally wear and see if it helps you figure out something about the person you're trying to get right on the page. Maybe a character you're working on is on vacation and normally wears a tie, but being on vacation doesn't have to wear a tie. So you might try to write with a tie and get a feel for what that's like, particularly if you don't usually feel what that's like, and then write without a tie. Maybe the
next couple hours and see, you know, how that feels to be released from that kind of costume or regular attire. And then maybe write and see what changes about that character for you. Those are really basic examples, I know, but maybe the specifics of what you're working on will help you figure out something unique to your work. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Every week I say that I would love your feedback about the show, and that is still true. And then every week I also say, let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors. But the show is pretty well booked, and I haven't said this publicly yet, but the show is going to come to a close in March. It will be 15 years that I have been broadcasting every week, telling you about different books and speaking to the authors, poets, and publishers of those books. Keep listening, keep enjoying. I'm not sure that I have space in my schedule for new authors, but I hope that you are enjoying the show. I still hope that you will give me feedback and let me know what you think. Okay. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.